If you've ever wondered where a trumpet comes from, you've come to the right place. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. We'll take a trip today, back and forth through time, taking a look at the brass instruments, both ancient and modern, and we'll have a listen as well. I hope you'll join me as we talk with Bruce Berry, founding member of the Chestnut Brass Company of Philadelphia, while we take a look at the life of the horn. Bruce, when and where did the life of the horn start? Do people know?
No, to be really specific about it, they can't really tell. They know that as soon as someone realized that it would be advantageous to be able to herd over a long distance, longer than they could shout, they started to try to figure out something. The earliest thing that we're really sure of would be if they were by the seashore, they would have a conch shell, and they would cut an end off the top, and they'd be able to make a sound with that. For most people, being an inland kind of a society, they'd have an animal horn of some sort. And basically, what works on this instrument works no matter how far forward we go. It's always the same thing that produces the sound for a brass instrument. In fact, instruments are classified by how they produce the sound. And for brass players, it's by buzzing our lips. If we get an even seal going across, like we went, we get just enough of a seal going across, we force air out of our body, and all of a sudden the lips start to vibrate. And in this instance, there's a little opening, a drill hole that's cut off, and that way we can get our whole signaling sound.
Now, what we're looking at and listening to is the horn of an animal. What kind of an animal is this, and how big for people who are listening, not looking at the show?
This is a steer, and we bought it in western Pennsylvania. It's approximately 12 inches long. At the smaller end, it's about a half inch, and its largest end, as it expands, it's approximately maybe 4.5 to 5 inches.
And it twists. It twists like an animal horn would be.
This is just the one we found. You could have a fancy one like an ibex horn. Obviously, in a lot of in the Jewish religion, it would be a ram's horn. So there are a lot of different kinds of things. Sometimes there were just a log that would be hollowed out so that they would be able to buzz into that. It doesn't have to be an animal horn, per se. It's just a long tubular device that you can buzz into that will amplify the buzz.
That's all you're doing in this case is amplifying it.
And then whatever I put in front of it enhances it.
A bullhorn, only this is a literal bullhorn.
Bullhorn, yeah.
Right.
You got it.
This is Conversations. We're talking today about horns. Our guest is Bruce Berry. Now, I read something that in the time of Charlemagne, Charlemagne's nephew was signaling to Charlemagne during the wars. Mm-hmm. He blew so hard on his animal horn that Charlemagne heard him several miles away. I think they used the word many miles away. But he also blew out an artery in his neck and cracked his horn. Is this a particularly hard thing to make a great sound that would travel miles with, or is this just a myth with Charlemagne and his nephew?
No, the sounds travel very well. You don't necessarily have to be someone that practices a whole lot. I would not say that having a vein bust in your side of your neck is an occupational hazard. Those things don't generally happen to anybody. They're a fluke. They're maybe a physical structure weakness on the person that you're talking about. Just by practicing the instrument and how you learn how well you buzz and it gets a more centered sound. And a centered sound just projects great. There might be one better animal horn over another, maybe a higher sound or a lower sound, depending on the individual. They just carry. That's why a brass instrument is the instrument that you want to have on a marching band or you use when you're in a cavalry charge and you have a bugle. It's just a great instrument for projecting along the ways.
It literally makes a great noise. It
makes a great noise. That's why whole walls and cities were supposed to be able to come down when you blow enough good trumpets.
Of course, there's that too.
There's that too.
When did this signaling device find music? Or
well,
did it?
There are some people that do some tunes on animal horns. This one particularly, there's a series of what we call the overtones, which happens on a brass instrument when you buzz at a faster rate and you start producing more notes and you stack them sort of on top of each other. This instrument is too short to get another note above it, but on a longer instrument, you start to be able to have more tones on the same instrument. And that's when you start to be able to do more musical things. The first thing they found out about this one was, they believe in the Scandinavian countries, was called a gemshorn. And they started to put some little holes in this, and by letting out the air, they could change the pitch just a little bit.
On the animal horn itself.
On the animal horn itself. And what it ended up to, or ended up next, was this instrument. And this instrument is obviously, could be considered a long animal horn or something.
It's a long, slender...
slender tube.
Angled tube. Not quite angled, but curving tube.
Curving tube. It wouldn't necessarily have to be. A cornetto, or zinc, as they're called, are Renaissance instruments. We know they existed around 1400. They would be made of wood. And in this instance, since this is a curved one, they would splint it down the middle and gouge it out with a knife. It appears black, even though it would be made of a fruit wood, like cherry wood, because it's wrapped in leather, and this binds the wood together. There were some cornettos that were straight, and on those you don't have to split them down the middle. You just use a smaller rod with some hard rock or fiber ripping material, and you would just hollow it out like you would a recorder.
Just shove and dig and shove
right,
and dig.
Right. But this one is the alto member of its family. They had a whole little assortment of sizes, and they have finger holes like recorders and flutes. It's sort of a hybrid, part woodwind, part brass. And they take the best things from each of those families at that time, since they were rather limited. We have six finger holes in the front, and there's one in the back. And this works on the upper ones of the cornetto family. And it's still a brass instrument because it's a little mouthpiece that we buzz into.
A mouthpiece is the cornerstone of a brass instrument, or the family of
brass? It's the most important thing, next to the player himself vibrating the lips. Yeah. And they're in different shapes depending on the kind of sound you're looking for. For example, a modern trumpet and a modern French horn mouthpieces, they're very different. One of the French horn has a very beautiful, lush sound,
yeah.
And it's funneled shape. A trumpet is more brilliant in its sound, and its cup shape. And that difference alone gives the characteristic sound differently. But this instrument sounds like this.
Sounds like what you think of as Renaissance music.
Right. It was a very popular instrument, and it was popular because everyone could play it. It wasn't that it was amazingly difficult. So there were little town bands that would play for civic occasions, maybe a wedding. The rich merchant would hire, and a couple of musicians would come in and play instruments such as this. Had a great repertoire. It was very versatile. It was the best wind instrument during the time of the Renaissance, partially because it has a range of 2.5 octaves chromatically. It projects very well. It's a pleasing sound. You can play it soft as well. Composers such as Gabrielli wrote for this instrument. It was used in the very first opera by Monteverdi, Orfeo, though it's a very challenging cornetto part. But it was a fun instrument. Now, opposite this, at that same time, is the other instrument, which is the trumpet, the natural trumpet of its day. And the natural trumpet was the only instrument that they regulated who was allowed to play it. It was it was even more a growing out of an instrument out of like the cow horn, in that it was a signaling device. And trumpet players were trained and in the service of kings. They learned calls that would maneuver the troops on the battlefield. If you were a good king, had some good trumpet players, they remembered the call, you probably won the battle. And so it was actually by decree, if you were found playing a trumpet and you weren't registered to play the trumpet, they physically harmed you so you couldn't play anymore. So it was a very special instrument to have.
Physically harmed you, lips or hands?
Lips and teeth.
Oh.
Because then you couldn't play again. Hands
literally
wouldn't really make any difference. Not greatly. This one doesn't really work on a finger hole kind of a system. And since it's just the tension of your lips that produces the sound, you just weren't supposed to play that instrument.
They were very serious about it.
They were very serious about it. The Doge of Venice had 8 silver trumpets and silver trumpet players that would follow him around the city and announce, every time he was doing something special. We're talking quite a lot of power and status here, having trumpet players.
Well,
but it's a basic thing.
Did trumpet players live better, given the fact that they seemed to be a special class?
I think that they definitely lived better than the average person. It was a journeyman system. You basically, like now, you had to know somebody to get on the list to learn. And you would spend many years learning. It wasn't like you right away became good enough to be a soloist. You spent the first 2 years just playing very low notes and getting a better sound, and you learn your specific military calls. They were, besides doing the civic and fun jobs, they also were in military service. In some instances, they were almost the diplomats of their day. They would deliver the message to the foreign troops, and they sometimes were held hostage. They were also one of the first people to be tried to be shot in a battle, because then they couldn't obviously make the signal. There's a legend about the Krakow in Poland, about under siege, one of the first persons killed was a trumpet player in the tower with an arrow through his throat. So not exactly a great job. But yes, I think to answer your question more specifically, they probably did live better than the average person, because they would be at the feasts. And being a modern day musician, you know, if you can go to a very fancy party and the help takes care of the help. You always seem to end up with some of the nice hors d'oeuvres and whatever else, because they take care of you. So yeah, it was probably a wonderful time. Of those people, if you couldn't be royalty, a social climber at least could have been the trumpet player.
This is Conversations on KUAC. We're talking to Bruce Berry. He is a founding member of the Chestnut Brass Company. It is a company based in Philadelphia. They travel worldwide, certainly around this nation. They teach children about ancient instruments as well as perform with orchestras. They perform solo. They are a quintet. Let me see now. They have two trumpets. Bruce is one of the trumpeters, a trombone, a French horn, and a tuba in this ensemble. They teach, they perform, they arrange, they commission music from modern composers. The Chestnut Brass Company of Philadelphia. Bruce Berry is our guest. Now, you have in your hand what is called a natural horn. We'll have to do double duty again for both radio and television. Mm-hmm. Can you first use this instrument to describe the different parts of a brass instrument for us?
Sure. This is a natural trumpet, or a Baroque trumpet, a Renaissance trumpet. Basically, once it got into this stage of development, it didn't change drastically for several hundreds of years. We have before us an elongated series of tubing.
How long is this tube if it was stretched out
straight? This particular one is pitched in C, which means it's 8 feet long.
Pitched in C, so it's eight feet
long.
It's the length that tells you
right,
how it's pitched?
Right. The modern C trumpet is 4 feet long. They work in multiples. It's the one time having some math skills helps as a musician. But this is 8 feet long, same as, for example, the organ stop that's 8 foot long is C on an organ. So although it's 8 feet long, this one has one extra loop, so it has three folds in it. In other words, there are two curved sections to it, and one flaring at one end, which is called the bell, which is used to help to project the sound. Physically, the only other thing that's different, there's a little globe on the end near the bell. Now, when we put instruments together, we solder them together to make them very stable. And at this time, they didn't do that. Instead, they would have a wooden block in here, and it would be wound with cord to hold it together. You would hold on to the knob with your left hand and hold it out like this. And your right hand, you would be holding the reins of a horse. You were supposed to be able to play these things mounted as well as just standing still. But the important thing is that it does have a mouthpiece into it and that we buzz into it. And on this instrument, since it's longer than the cow horn, I can give you an idea of what happens by just changing your lips. I'll start at the bottom. I'll play a low note and I'll go as high as I can go. Each time I'm increasing the speed that I'm buzzing. And what happens is down low, the notes are really far apart, but you can play them pretty loud, and this is where they would play their military calls. As they go higher, they get closer and closer together, and finally, near the upper portion of the range, they're close enough that they're scale-wise and you can play melodies. And I'll play a melody so you can see why everyone thought this was the sound to have around the castle.
The natural horn.
Popular wedding tune, Now and Then.
This is a solo instrument.
It can be. It wasn't always just a solo instrument. There are a number of double concertos, actually concertos for four. There's even one concerto we know of for seven trumpets. And they would very often come to the king's table afterwards. And since you can only play those series of 10 notes that I played for you, they could make up tunes just because they were so well-versed in the theory of their day and the form. And they could make up a tune while they stood at table. And they would have entertaining music for maybe six, eight trumpets, whatever. Depends on how rich a monarch you happen to work for. But it was a great solo instrument. The Brandenburg was written for an instrument slightly smaller than this, in the key of F, not in the key of C. But it was a wonderful instrument. The works that you hear by Bach and Handel, this is the trumpet that they were thinking of when they were thinking of the trumpet. And it's a glorious sound.
Absolutely. Majestic when you play it as you've just played it now. When a maker of a brass instrument was making a brass instrument, he, I assume, in that period, was working with a hammer?
Are he was working
beating?
With a hammer.
What is it? Does he start with a mound of brass?
They start with a sheet, basically like a piece of paper, and you have what we call a mandrel, or a shape that you're desiring that metal to be in. You then wrap the metal around it and repeatedly hit it until it becomes seamless. In other words, it's not arc welding or soldered. Instead, it's repeatedly hitting it over and over again, and eventually the metal blends in. It also means that the metal is not perfectly even all the way around, and it gave the instrument some flexibility, but that's how they made them. And so even the little curves that you see at this end here, the bow, what we call a bow on the trumpet, is very difficult for them to do. The metal kept splitting, and they learned they had to fill it first with tar to get it to bend around another shape, and then they would remove the tar.
Just poke the tar out.
Yeah.
Talking about that curve, of course, that's the curve in the tubing.
Right.
When you talk about the unevenness in the instrument, is that going to affect the quality of the sound?
Right. It's going to quite drastically affect the quality of sound, and in some instances, the flexibility of what the instrument is. You buy a modern trumpet, the metal is spun by machines, so they can regulate it to be exactly even all the way around. And in some instances, that's why we say, oh, that instrument has a wonderful centered sound to it. Mm. And on these instruments, that wasn't possible. But instead, what it gave them was a wonderful, you notice that sounded softer than the modern trumpet, well, maybe almost pastel in its kind of color. And also what it does for the instrument is it enables you to lip the notes and bend them pitch-wise with your lips a little bit easier without being able to detect that I'm doing that. On an instrument that's centered, if I start to push the instrument higher or lower, you're going to be able to hear that timbre difference. The color will slightly change, and that way the notes won't sound even through the trumpet. But on this instrument, that wasn't so that they could humor, so to speak, as we call it, the notes that weren't in tune, because, after all, someone was making this with a hammer.
Was it more challenging for musicians, say, three or four musicians playing together, to play together and to be in tune on pitch?
Generally, at that time in the Renaissance, the instruments would be made by the same maker. You know, we have now what we call standardization of pitch. It varies a little bit from city to city or country to country, but we know basically A is going to be 440 or 442. That's how many cycles the physical wave makes per second. But during this time, there was nothing like that. So basically, if you were going to order trumpets from Nuremberg, Germany, and have them play in a consort together, you'd say, I want four instruments. And they should work together.
And the maker would tune them by hammering them before he sent them to you. They
right.
would all be
the local trumpet player
play
would
together.
Play them, and they come with little tuning bits, little mm-hmm. small little bits that you can put in to help make minor adjustments. But basically, they would come hopefully to work at one thing, and that's why they would maybe make it work with the local organ. So generally, there was a great teamwork involved. There'd be a maker in a town, probably some really great trumpet players that used his instruments, and then there'd be a composer, for example, like Bach, that would exploit the wonderfulness of both the maker making these great instruments and these musicians who were superb musicians, and they would end up having great pieces just because of that. And it happened in a number of towns. I mean, we know the trumpet player, the maker, and Bach in his town. We know, if you go over to England, Valentine Snow was the trumpet player that Purcell wrote the things like the trumpet voluntary for. And they know the maker there was a man named John Bull. And now they make copies of these instruments, which are in museums. And you can even find CDs occasionally with the original instrument being played on them. And when you hear them, it's a very great sound.
Once again, we're talking with Bruce Berry. He was educated in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Music Academy. He is a founding member of the Chestnut Brass Company, also of Philadelphia. He's been featured as a soloist in the Bach Brandenburg Concerto at the Princeton Bach Festival with orchestras throughout the Northeast. He is an expert, I dare to say, in the field of ancient music, also an arranger of music himself. This is Bruce Berry. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and we're talking about the life of the horn. We have one more instrument on the table before us. That is it, I should ask this, is this the precursor of the trombone?
You're correct.
All right. This is a sackbut. Can we describe this instrument?
Well, I'll describe it in 1 second, because I'm going to tell you why the sackbut.
All right, good.
Because you heard the natural trumpet. You heard me hit those 12 notes. That's not enough notes to play fully chromatic. The natural trumpet can play in different keys, but it can only play in one key at a time. So they liked the idea of the sound gotten by a buzzing instrument. They wanted to keep that. So the sackbut produces its sound by buzzing, and that's great. But instead of having to take the instrument apart to change the length of its tubing, it's built with two parallel tubes, tubes within tubes, that you can push and pull. And push and pull is what the word sackbut means in Flemish, also to unsheath as in a sword, because it basically looks like that's what you're doing when you start taking it apart. So we have an instrument that changes its length with the tubing while you're playing it, and you buzz into it. It can play any note that you need, and it's a great sounding instrument. I don't play the trombone. But this instrument that I'm holding is the tenor sackbut. It's the same amount of tubing as the modern trombone. There are two big differences. What we call the bore of the instrument, the diameter of the tubing, it's much smaller than a modern trombone. And this area, which is the bell, you see that it doesn't flare so much. And even if we got to the Baroque era, we would see an instrument that flared more than this. And now the modern trombone obviously has a very large bell. And that's because you're looking for a more open, bigger sound. Basically, the history of musical instruments follows a progression of larger orchestras demanding more colors and louder instruments. And so that's why now the orchestras tend to play a lot louder than a smaller orchestra of Bach's time, which would have been maybe 12 people.
These instruments, with the exception of the animal horn, began to emerge around the time of the Renaissance.
Right.
The Renaissance was a time of great blossoming. Is it simply all the blossoming that created this? People started to experiment and play?
I think that the natural trumpets happened because of warfare, mostly being a military instrument. The other ones, I think, started to come in more because of as art instruments, and because people had more time. You had a rising merchant class in a lot of instances. People had more money, they wanted to have a good time, and they were able to have it by having music. Obviously, you need some entertainment. They didn't have TV or radio. And generally, a lot of people learned to play instruments because that was their thing to do in the evening. We learned, if you read some of the stories about kings or any of those people, they tended to play musical instruments. They tended to know about astrology. That's why they, you know, now we use the term Renaissance man for someone that seems more educated in only their one narrow field. And that was the time that I think it was everybody was interested in all the things, and communication started to be better. And so it was fueling itself. So yeah, it was a great time for these instruments, and I think they had a wonderful assortment of instruments. They're wonderful colors.
If you'd been a trumpet player in the Renaissance, would you have played a different trumpet? Not a physical trumpet, but would you have played differently than you play now?
I think probably somewhat, yeah. Obviously, there's only one way to produce the sound, whether as many people would be as wonderful players as we have today. It's hard to say because obviously there are more people playing trumpet now as well. Each generation, I think, gets better because the players before it impart that knowledge down. One of the reasons Americans are considered such great brass players now is in this century, we've had so many great brass players, and a lot of them have been great teachers, so it's better. But I think I would play slightly different. I would still play probably okay. You know, I think that when you say, when you hear a piece like the Brandenburg, you go, how could they have done that? Well, the second Brandenburg, if you were lucky enough to hear it, I think 2 weeks ago or a couple of weeks ago with a symphony here, it's a hard trumpet part, but at the same time, if that's what you do for a living, just like anything else, you sit and learn it. If you look at the wonderful woodwork that was done at that time, it took a lot of patience too. When you have time, you invest it, and that's the thing that they learned to do.
Did these instruments develop into what we think of as more entertainment instruments at a particular time? Did they move off the battlefield, out of the royal court?
Yeah, they did move off the battlefield. We start getting into the classical period. That was people like Haydn had orchestras that had trumpet players. They didn't play the fancy parts that we heard in the Baroque, the high, wonderful, florid trumpet parts. Instead, they were mostly tonic dominant, very simple things. We had the hunting horn, which came out of being an instrument used on the field to being the wonderful instrument used indoors that we now associate with. Originally, it was a big hooped instrument, and they put it over their shoulders, and they would play as loud as humanly possible outdoors. When they started having operas, and they would want to depict that wonderfulness of the hunt, I guess basically from the offstage thing to try to tell you what dialogue they couldn't work in, what was happening in the plot, they brought the horns in the pit to symbolize that pastoral quality of the hunt. And so they had to make the instrument slightly smaller. They had to make them able to play in different keys. And the horn actually, during that classical period, was the best brass instrument. It had a rich solo literature with you have the works of Mozart, because they learned how to make the instrument play throughout its range in a more, if you're a horn player, you'll say it's a better sound than the trumpet, but it's at least a lovely, lush sound. And they were able to do solo literature. The trumpet, the trombone, they were there, but not in such a prominent role. The horn was the great solo instrument during the classical period.
Of that time.
But then we get a little bit further, and things start to change. They decide that they're going to use this idea of the cornetos to changing with finger holes on some instruments, and they came up with what they called a keyed bugle. We don't have one this time today. We didn't bring them on this trip to Alaska, maybe the next time. But it's an instrument where you take a bugle, like a modern bugle, but you put keys all over it, like saxophone keys. And through those mechanisms, still with a cup mouthpiece, you buzz into it, you get a fully chromatic instrument. It's a very soft sound.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking today with Bruce Perry. Is that sound reminiscent of a saxophone sound?
It's much softer than what we would now say is a trumpet sound. It doesn't sound quite so reedy as a saxophone does, though. Maybe closer maybe to a clarinet sound in that kind of open, resonant quality. It doesn't have that extra fibrous quality that a sax does. But it's a very soft instrument. And it was a big solo instrument. It was the big advancement. And they made a whole family of sizes. And that was really great because now they had a large bass instrument that could produce a lot of sound that was fully chromatic. And the sound, it wasn't quite even, because the holes were not, as close as they were to the mouthpiece, they would sound fuzzy. The further away they got, the more resonant they sounded. But it was a good step. And during the next step, when they invented the valve, which is the biggest thing that happened to us, which was in 1810, then things really took off and brass instruments became an instrument that everybody could learn to play. Because up until this time, either through regulations or just general availability, being all handmade was difficult. But we get into the 1830s and we're talking the Industrial Revolution. And all of a sudden we have machining techniques that can mass produce instruments. And then during the Civil War in our country, there were lots and lots of bands, and that was the big movement. And then after that, people played them in their house so that everybody could learn to play them. They weren't difficult. And even in England, they have mill bands where people are factory workers, but they play music. And that brought it forward to today.
This is a people's instrument, the brass instrument.
It's approachable. I think it's what everybody, you know, you think of an instrument. Most people probably will, anymore, I guess you think because of the videos, you think of saxophone. But in maybe 10 years ago, you would still think probably of a brass instrument, of a brass band coming down the 4th of July parade.
Sure.
Yeah. It was special.
I don't even know how to ask this question, but it's a question that's been wandering around in my mind. A brass instrument sound is sexy, sensuous, it's sweet, it's mm-hmm. profound, it can be reverent, majestic. It covers such a huge range. And it can make us laugh. I was mm-hmm. listening to you when you played, and there was a point where I couldn't contain myself. I just had to laugh. What is it about this instrument that can do so much?
I think it is probably since it's very few outside parts are really responsible for a lot of what happens. Because it's really your lips that produces the sound. You have an image of a sound in your head. But the only thing more personal than that is when you sing, because it's your vocal cords. Everything else, you know, you take a saxophone. There's a piece of reed that you're depending on. You know, this is still me. You know, it's not a reed, and a flute splits the air column as it goes into the hole. A drum only hits a piece of skin. And I think that's one of the reasons that the flexibility of image and being able to convey so many different moods is so tremendous on brass instruments, is because it's so much a person kind of an instrument.
It's connected to the human being who's playing without anything in the middle.
And it's also one of the reasons that the sounds can be so diverse from player to player.
Oh.
You know, maybe now because of the media having such great access, you know, you can buy CDs of orchestras from all around the world. Now there's such a great exchange of this information. The concepts are changing a little bit, but in the 30s and the 40s in this country, you could put on a record and tell, oh, that was the Boston Symphony, and this was the New York Philharmonic. You knew what the sound of those brass players in those individual cities. And I think that's one of the reasons, if you read essays about someone traveling in the Renaissance, someone's diary, they'll mention what a glorious sound this trumpet player had. And it was common, I think now it seems uncommon that someone would mention that to someone. But when you read the diaries, it must have been very impressive. If you went home and in your diary, one of the things you mentioned that night was the cornetto sounded like a ray of sunshine coming through a window, or this trumpet had the silver sound of you know, majesty. So it had to be very special, otherwise it wouldn't be able to touch people that way. And I think you're quite right. Brass instruments touch people in a way much more than some other instruments.
But they just reach through. Why did you start playing trumpet? Where did trumpet come to you?
You know, that's the hardest question. I was hoping you wouldn't going to ask that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I get asked that a lot. And my mother played the piano, but no one else played any instrument. And I never showed any interest at all to play an instrument. And I'm from New York State. And there around fourth grade, they have people come into the schools and play instruments. And one day I just came home and said, I'm going to play the trumpet. They still wonder where that came from. But I guess, you know, it's like you said, it reaches out and it touches you.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's just out of nowhere, I'm just going to learn to play the trumpet. And that's one of the reasons I'm really happy that we do so many children's concerts. Because you can hear something on the TV or on the radio or whatever, but when you hear live music, you hear someone reaching out, and it makes a big mark on people. You see that really great light in their eyes, and their whole face smiles up just like
sure.
yours. And you see that with a whole room full of 9-year-olds. Boy, you know that a couple of those people are going to play the trumpet. And that's why. So I don't know why I do, but I love the trumpet, always have, and it's been very special to me. I've gotten to do a lot of wonderful things that I wouldn't have done otherwise. Like, for example, I don't think I would have gotten here to Alaska had I not played the trumpet.
Well, welcome and thanks to your trumpet. Bruce Berry is with us. He is with the Chestnut Brass Company of Philadelphia. Early music, how did that happen to your life?
I read a book that talked about the cornetto in England, and where I lived, it was our library had on loan a reference librarian from England. And he said, well, you know, I'm going home to visit. If you'd like to have one of these, I'll get one for you. Because I guess I said to him, have you ever seen one of these things? I read it in the book, and knowing that, you know, English accents stick out even on Long Island, I said, you know, do you know anything about these? And he said, oh, yes. And it happened that the main person that makes them lived very near where he did. So he went and got me a cornetto. And so when I was in high school, I had a cornetto. And I thought, boy, this was really unusual. And that was right around the time when a lot of early music was really beginning to happen, the early 70s. And I started to see such trumpet players' names as Edward Tarr playing the natural trumpet. And as soon as I could get one after that, I got a natural trumpet. And when we started playing on the street in 1977, we'd walk to our street corner. In Philadelphia, there's a place called Antique Row on Pine Street, and there's all these antique stores. And I walked down, and one day, and there was an instrument hanging up in the window, and I didn't know what it was. And so I said, well, if I don't know what it is, I probably should get it. And I did, and it turned out to be an E-flat over-the-shoulder sax horn, which was a peculiar, an American invention. And that was between having a cornetto and a natural trumpet, and the other person that's a founding member left in the quintet now, Jay, our tuba player, had done some research, part of his master's paper, on the history of the tuba. And we said, you know, this is really intriguing. If we find it this interesting and this approachable, audiences are going to like it as well. And over the years, we've found a variety of instruments. The Renaissance instruments that we have are all reproductions. But we have a wonderful collection of instruments from the 1830s through 70s. We have a full set of keyed bugles, which means a soprano E-flat key bugle, which is a soloist instrument used here in America. A B-flat bugle, which was used basically wherever there were bugles. We have a quinticlef, which is extremely rare. And we have an ophicleide. So we normally would travel with these instruments, maybe the next time we're here. But we have sax horns, and all these instruments sound so very different. So when you come to one of our concerts, you hear not just the sound of the modern brass quintet, which, although it's great, the whole history of brass, you hear such an assortment of colors, and there's still that personal touch that reaches through, but the timbres are very different. Sometimes they're warm and very friendly. Sometimes they're a little more brassy and strident. But that's why it's such a fun group to play in. And the early instruments makes, to me, a big difference. I've learned things about playing modern pieces from playing early instruments, and I've brought some of the things from modern pieces I've learned to my early instruments. And between those two, I think they have made me a more rounded musician, and I certainly have kept my life fun, which is the prime thing.
Is there something about the brass instruments in your life that is like the common saying about books, too many books, not enough time? Is there too much music, not enough time for you?
Oh, no, I usually manage to find it all. I usually say there are an awful lot of good trumpets, and most of them shouldn't end up at my house. I'm always trying to find another trumpet, whether it's an unusual old trumpet or a replica of a special instrument or getting a new trumpet. They're fun. They all have different personalities, the same as anything else, and as you practice them, you learn more about them. You learn how to be more flexible so you can create more moods for your audience out of them. So it's a very rich resource to have. It's special.
Talk to me a little bit more about buzzing your lips. Maybe you can help us with your modern trumpet. This is a B-flat trumpet?
This is a B-flat trumpet. If you were going to
For people
begin
who
trumpet
can't
this
see,
year.
This is a traditional, this is what we think of as a traditional modern trumpet.
Your basic trumpet like you would see in your local music store, for the most part. And it's not hard to learn to play a brass instrument. You know the old soup song, mm-mm, good. Mm. Well, when you make that mm sound, you make an even seal going across the bottom lip. between your two lips. And that's not a lot of pressure, it just closes it off. That's all you really need.
No air.
No, that mm-hmm. means that's it. And then as I take a breath and I buzz it past that, because it's firm, they vibrate. Now, in my parts of my trumpet, we mentioned before, we have the mouthpiece. That's the important thing. Now, when I take the mouthpiece, all that's going to do is channel that buzz. So it's going to make it a little more presentable.
Makes what we think of as a sound.
A sound. It's a little bit more definable. When you put it into the trumpet is really just an amplifier of that sound, like a cone shape that's going to make it go better. And then when I add it in, so it's not that difficult to do. I mean, you spend years learning how to do it, but that doesn't mean it's difficult either. You sound pretty presentable on a trumpet in about 6 months if you work at it a little bit.
This, when it goes through the coil and out mm-hmm. the bell, it makes a much more rounded sound
than the buzz by itself.
It.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
That's true.
What happens with the keys?
The keys or the buttons, as we sometimes call them, are called valves. And what they are is, if you think of turning the faucet, you're basically opening up a set of pipe. And that's what these are. By pressing the valves up and down, I'm opening up a channel. And connected to the valves, the long cylinders, are other little sets of pre-measured lengths of tubing. And by their lengths, they determine how much it's going to lower. And it works in mathematics. One of the valves lowers it a half step, one lowers it a whole step. So obviously when you combine them together, you get a step and a half. And then the third one is a step and a half.
It gives you more access to more tubing.
Right. So basically, this is like seven natural trumpets put together, because there are seven combinations with the three valves. And that's how it works out. It's the same as on the trombone. There are seven positions on the trombone. So it's the mathematics involved in these instruments. But it's not hard at all. And you learn to buzz your lips, and you produce your sound.
Give us more than a single note on this trumpet. More than a single note.
Okay, a couple of notes. Turn of the century cornet solo called Hocus Pocus.
Now this instrument, Bruce, is made by computer and laser.
Right, this is my newest trumpet, and this one is made by Cliff Blackburn in Tennessee. They use a computer to generate the sound instead of having a player do it. And the reason for that is, when you take away the player, it means that he might make a trumpet that plays great for me if he's using me as the person to buzzing, but what about the next person? So by having the computer do it, they can make the overtones, that's those series of notes that I played on the natural trumpet, all line up perfectly, or get the same even sound, the same even pitch qualities to it. So it's makes it a better instrument. They can regulate the thickness of the metal more precisely, and they change this thickness, and it may not look like it. When you look at the piece of metal, it looks like it's a straight piece of metal, but it's tapered, and there are gradual parts of the metal that is thicker because it's desired to have them there, and it changes the sound. It's one of the ways you can regulate the sound on the trumpet. So by working with the computer, they can make the instrument project better. They work with the alloys. That's the mixture of the different metals in the combinations to make it work for the way you want it to work. For example, on this one it's made of ambronze underneath the silver. And the ambronze is supposedly the best metal that they have found yet to make this trumpet project the best. And what it means, if it projects the best, it means I have to work less hard when I'm playing loud to be able to have a wonderful, majestic trumpet sound to carry over, say, an orchestra of 100 people.
Is there any loss or is it all gain in turning to computers and lasers? I'm thinking about the man who hammered the piece of brass in the 1400s.
That's a hard question to say. I think what it does do is it makes more of the instruments consistent at that level. The man working with a hammer, I'm sure he turned out some good instruments. I'm sure they were, in some instances, quirky, where obviously if I spent enough time working on it, it was going to work out. But that doesn't mean, like in this instance, every trumpet coming out is going to be pretty much consistently great.
Is there a state of the art that hasn't been reached? Do trumpet players imagine, dream of something that's not here in your hand yet?
Oh, trumpet players are always dreaming of those kind of things. They'll always do more things. Right now, they're working with the alloys and the taperings. At one point, they were trying to put the valves in different parts where they would work out better physically for the instrument and having them work with solar-powered motors or this and that. So, yeah, they'll always keep on tampering it if they think they can make it better. And obviously they will, because people always learn more things. Not necessarily from the trumpet, but from whatever other things happen in industry, of course they'll learn some other better things. And so, yeah, it will be better. Same as it's better than this instrument in some ways, but I'm still quite happy to play the natural trumpet because it's a different sound. And so I think it just makes my toolbox has greater choices, or if I was a painter, there are more colors to paint with.
Yeah. Once again, this is Bruce Berry with Chestnut Brass. The name comes from Philadelphia's Chestnut Street. The original players played at the corner of Chestnut and 17th in Philadelphia. Okay. I understand someone asked you to perform at a gig and said, "What's your name?" And you looked at the street sign.
Right. Well, it seems like that happens rather often. People feel better about hiring someone that has a name. So, yes, that's why.
They are masters, the five of them, of the Renaissance, Baroque, and Classical periods. They also play a good deal of modern music. They have a number of works arranged for them, and you do arranging yourselves.
I do some of the arranging, but mostly what I do are reductions of some of the 1850 music and some of the Renaissance things. Our best arranger in the group is Jay, who's done a lot of wonderful arrangements, the tuba player, Jay Crush. Mm-hmm. And Jay's able to do an assortment of whatever you need. He can, if you want it to sound like Renaissance music, it'll sound like Renaissance music. And if you're looking for classy, sophisticated jazz arrangements, he'll do that as well, whether it's Gershwin or whatever. And he's also a serious composer. Arranging is only one of the things he does. He writes in a lot of wonderful music himself. And so you never know what guys you'll hear one of the people from the group doing.
You have a quintet with breadth, depth, don't you?
It's important. It's one of the reasons that it stays fresh. It has a lot of variety to it. If you're in a big company, you'd always be hiring new people or consultants to bring in new ideas. For us, it's how inventive we can be, how investigative. You know, it's you can't stop reading, you can't stop looking or being open-minded. As long as you're willing to have information come into you, it's a great environment. And for that reason, the quintet, although it's been together for 15 years and maybe isn't as well-known as we'd like it to be, it's a wonderful place to be a musician, because no matter what I practice, I'm pretty sure Jay's going to use it in the next piece. And it makes it challenging. It means that things don't become stale. And I think that's the most anybody can ask for, is that constantly have new challenges put in front of you. And in music, that's one of the great things. We get to choose the music we play. That's exciting, because a lot of people don't. So we have some of the direction things that happen are part of it. So it's a wonderful quintet.
Why do you commission work? Why do you ask composers to create new work for you?
We wouldn't have old music if somebody didn't ask them to write it. The music we have written now is going to be old music. You know, you can only for so long can you only play Bach or Haydn or whatever. Also, people today have just as much creativity as they did in the past time. It's harder in some instances because we want to prejudge and narrow it down to only the good pieces. Mm. But there were, you know, hundreds of years of taking care of that with all the other people. And so it's not for us to maybe judge so critically. We try to commission a wide range of pieces. In other words, we try to have composers that write very different from each other. So when we maybe even have two on a program for our audience, they'll see quite a difference between the two. And I think that says that, you know, you might not like one, but maybe you'll like the other, just like you would in reading a novel. And so that's part of it. And I think partly you have to help your art form develop and grow. And it's also very exciting being an artist to work with wonderful composers. When they come in, you know, they hear tapes of their group, and they might have other ideas of what they're looking for in a piece, but you know that some of the strengths of your group are going to be reflected in those pieces, and that makes you a part of history as well. And it makes a big difference. You know, you have to help enrich them, and the pieces that we've had written for us certainly show that there will be some challenging things in the future. I guess our tapes must sound pretty good to the composers. But there have been a lot of wonderful things. Some of them have been very inventive, very unusual. And so that's exciting. And it makes a big difference. And you know, you work on a piece, you're the first person ever to play it. That's the same, in a way, as being the first person to climb a mountain.
Sure, sure.
And so it's another one of those real pluses.
I spoke with a composer some time ago who said that he felt that modern music, what we think of as that collective modern music, has passed through a period of dissonance where the common listener found it a little grating on the ear, but that modern music in his mind is beginning to reach into all areas of music now, is beginning to lose its kind of alienated, dissonant sound. What's your sense of modern music, where it's been and where it's going in the last 20, next 20 years?
Well, I guess to call it all dissonant seems kind of narrow. There is a lot of it that I'm sure that if you don't listen to much of it, is very unapproachable. I can't say that every piece of modern music I hear, I like. And sometimes I can't say that you're supposed to like it, to be honest. There's some things that are written for political reasons and are statement pieces, and they aren't necessarily that you're going to walk home listening to them. I think you are able to absorb and have a better vocabulary for anything when you are exposed to more of it. If you only hear one piece of new music, you're probably not going to like it. You're right. And in a way, there's no reason you should like it if that's all you're given. And maybe you won't necessarily go to all the concerts you need to. But that's why, for example, we always do contemporary music. You have to help educate everybody, whether it's me, the performer, you, the listener. And by hearing all those pieces, you're going to be a better person for it. You know, you're going to be able to, you know, we played a piece that was written for us that we love. And 2 months after one performance, we got a letter in the mail from someone that hated it. Just this whole page and a half about how much they hated it. And we talked about it in the quintet, and we were really happy about it. Not happy that they hated it, but happy that they thought so much about it that it still bothered them that 2 months later they wrote us a letter. Because I think when we talk to composers about it, they say, all we're really looking for is for somebody to listen. And isn't that what a lot of people are looking for, you know, in their daily lives? So being able to play contemporary music is just being able to experience. Things are going to sound dissonant, but a lot of things in today's society that are dissonant. Mm-hmm. Why should the music not reflect that as well?
And move some portion of the society in one way or the other, love it, hate it.
There are a lot of contemporary pieces that I listen to that I think are extremely lyrical and very melodic. And I think some of that is because some people are offshoots and different branches off that are experiencing more of that in their lives, as a lot of people do. You know, if you only talk to a grumpy person about a city, your outlook of that city is going to be a lot less positive than if you talk to someone that's optimistic that lives in that same place.
Is this a very free time for a brass instrument player?
What do you mean by free?
the earliest trumpeters were signalers. The next set of trumpeters were heralds. They could, that's what they did. It seems to me that if I think about a trumpet after I think about Louis Armstrong, some of my other favorite trumpet players, I think about a brass band, a military band. Mm-hmm. Have there been periods, maybe I'll ask it this way, have there been periods in the life of the horn that have been pretty much confined by society?
Oh, yeah.
To one kind of playing?
Yes, very much so. But I think that's not so much now. I know that brass bands, for example, exist. They're beginning to happen in America now. I think they also happen in Canada. They were, or I guess maybe they still are, quite a society thing in England, where it's definitely blue-collar people that play them. But I listen to those people, and I'm amazed about their ability to communicate their music. I'd be happy to buy a brass band record anytime and listen to it. I think today, if you play the trumpet, it's a wonderful assortment of things that you can do. There's obviously you could play in a symphony, but you could be a soloist. You could play, in some places, you could play in a band, not that many anymore, just because of the way the arts are. But you could play in a brass quintet. You could be a teacher at an assortment of levels, which is amazing, and each one has their challenges and special rewards to it. So I think that, you know, you can play commercial music, you could play reggae, you could play society bands, play weddings and things. Although that might not be the most stimulating thing intellectually, it earns a living. And a lot of people do things that they don't necessarily love to do a living. So to get to play the trumpet in any form is, to me, is still positive, because playing the trumpet's great. So
Bruce Berry and the other members of the Chestnut Brass Company are on the faculty at Temple University. When did you join the faculty, and what kind of an experience has that been for the five of you?
That came relatively late in the ensemble's history. I think this is our fourth year, roughly fourth year. And it's fun. It's an ongoing process. Sometimes we do more of the things we like, sometimes a few less. We're primarily a touring group. We're on the road about 100 days a year traveling. So when we're not on the road, we race back and teach lessons. We don't teach, for example, classes where we're responsible to be there every week. But we teach how to play the trumpet, the French horn, the trombone, the tuba. And it's a lot of fun. We do a lot of recruiting things for them in the Philadelphia area and Western Pennsylvania, working with young people. And that's exciting, because you can really make a big difference by showing them some of the things that you've worked on, and you speed up their learning process, so it's great. We do presentations for comp classes. In other words, people studying composition will go in and talk about what you can write for brass, what are the possibilities, and then they'll write some pieces. We'll come in and read them down for them so they can hear what they're trying to work out. So it's
read them down, play them.
Play them, sorry,
them.
Yeah. So that they can have that experience of taking what's in their head, putting it on paper, and get an immediate feedback. One of the hardest things for a composer is very often they write down pieces, but they can't always find people to play them right away. That's why people need to play contemporary music and listen to it, because that way the composer gets feedback. People didn't like it or did like it. And it helps. You'll get better pieces when they get more feedback and they get more pieces played.
We join the composer's reality by living in his world, hearing, playing.
It's very hard to develop a craft that you don't ever get to hear. If all you ever do is hear it in your head, that you don't ever get the full emotional expression of it until you hear a live performance. Live performances can be boring, but more often than not, they can be very electric, especially in contemporary music, because musicians aren't so complacent about it. It's still fresh and new to them, so it's much more gripping. Like when you go hear jazz, since so much of it's improvised, it's much more gripping in some instances, because people take chances. People go out on the limb to make the phrase just right or whatever. And that kind of thing, when it happens in classical music, in contemporary music, or any other kind of music, is why live music is so special, and going to a concert can be such an uplifting experience.
Yeah, music. We have just about 3 minutes left. Would you take us on a short tour of our instruments again? Remind
sure.
people of our sounds?
Okay. We have our animal horn, yeah. which is the earliest one, and it's a not necessarily pretty, but functional.
This is the instrument that is the artery burster. It is the one that they brought the sheep home with, called the armies to battle.
That's it.
I assume called Harry to dinner, right?
Could have been.
Something.
Could have been.
Sure. The animal horn.
Next one is the cornetto or the zinc hybrid, part woodwind, part brass. A wooden instrument with a little mouthpiece that we buzz our lips into to get that brass sound. Very sweet, very quiet, but a pretty sound.
I hear tambourines and light drums when you play
this. I did
this.
Too.
Are these? Are
it's
these,
the tune.
Is it the tune, or was this instrument accompanied by?
Oh, it would have been accompanied by those kind of things: tambourines, probably some recorders, maybe one sackbut with it, and it's a happy instrument.
How long did this instrument live? What was its life?
Roughly 1400 through. The last major composer to write for it was Bach in some of his early cantatas, but he was considered old-fashioned, so maybe the early 1700s.
So 300 years is a good life, 250 or so.
Yeah. It's a pretty good one. Mm. And we have our natural trumpet, which is basically just the mouthpiece, a length of tubing and a bell at one end. Changing the lip tension, we get a whole bunch of different notes. It's melody, but it could have been not so happy. And it can sound a little more like the military instrument that it is. And then we go forward in time, we end up with the modern one.
And it when you were playing the natural trumpet, it leaves the... Well, it doesn't. I was going to say it leaves majesty for... But then I had to say majesty. It, both of those sounds, the military and the regal sound, are...
They're similar. Yeah. I guess one sounds maybe a little bit more aggressive or hostile.
Yeah. The human race. Give us a last riff on this trumpet and we'll say goodnight. Gorgeous. Bruce Berry, thanks very much for a most engaging hour. I hope you'll come back to Alaska and join us again.
Hope to. Thanks for having me.
Good. I'm Susan McGinnis with Conversations, and I hope you'll join me again next week.